Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and invest in yourself today. Here at the Business Creators Radio Show, we take you to those places where you have those mastermind meetings and aha moments that can change your trajectory or at least bring you a little bit closer to serving from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. Now, today, we have somebody with us who's been on the Business Creators Radio Show before, and I really enjoyed my previous conversation with him. But it's been a few years, and not only does he have some updates for us, but there's things that have changed in his industry, and it's an industry that actually affects all of us in some way that he has to be on the show again, and I was more than delighted to have him back for another run. His name, and if this is a blast from the past for a few of you, that means I actually have devoted listeners. His name is Damian Lupo, who you might have seen around elsewhere. And essentially, he's a serial entrepreneur and best-selling author in personal finance who is rewriting the rules and plans for retirement. Damon has $438 million in assets under management and has raised hundreds of millions of dollars. He is now on a mission to free 1 million everyday investors from the broken traditional retirement system. I could use that liberation, Damon. Come on in. The weather's fine.
Man, it's great to be back, Adam. It's great to be here. It's been a while. It's been years.
Yeah. All right. So what we like to do here at Business Creators Radio is I read off your official bio. Very impressive. So much so, I'm not sure I'm worthy to be in your presence. But what I want to do is go behind the curtain and discover a bit about your journey and what's brought you to where you are, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. So go for it.
Gosh, man, let's do a little rewind. It's like an 80s retro moment. Mm-hmm. But going back, I think this journey just started with acknowledging being a creator, being an entrepreneur. And that, you know, that started back in Alaska when I was growing up. And I started off just solving a problem. And the problem was my parents told me no. And I think that that's probably a good place to start for most people. If you're talking about starting something, building something, somebody saying no or there's some problem. My parents told me we didn't have any money and we couldn't afford Nintendo games. And so I went out there and started a business and hired them to actually help me turn around and buy these things. And that just evolved over time into starting a business in college that I started a bookstore. And that is funny. The bookstore I started put the other bookstore out of business and they threw me out of school. So I've always been willing to do something that made maybe take a broken system and try to solve a problem for other people and serving other people. And over the years that led into doing a lot of real estate and solving housing problems. And then it evolved after 2008. I think we talked about this last time, losing $20 million and going basically starting over being homeless. It shifted my thinking after that event into a place where I asked, all right, is it just about the money? Is it about the success or is it about something else? And ultimately what I came to was an understanding that it's about impacting other people and solving problems for other people. And when you focus on that, the money becomes a side effect. That's where EQRP was born. Helping people get their retirement accounts out of Wall Street and putting them in their hands to where they can control it. And they're not on a roller coaster. After doing that for a number of years, it dawned on me that a lot of people were excited about having control of their money, but then they didn't really know where to go with it. Since we spoke last time, the effort has been on creating opportunities like the manufacturing plant that we're building to help solve a big problem for both investors and communities. And this, I think we've heard this over the last few years about building America, building back America. And we're doing everything we can to do that, to really build something where everybody wins. And that's I think that's the place that I would say I come from today, is finding something that is so inspirational that I get excited about waking up Monday morning to go serve, and everybody is a winner. There's nobody losing because we're winning. And that's where I'm at in life. And I think that that's the winning playbook and the winning plan for anybody that's out there thinking, how am I going to win? What am I supposed to do? It's about finding ways for you to be involved in something that you care about where everybody wins. And sometimes that's a little challenging, but I can tell you that's where you wake up excited, and you don't wake up just feeling like it's never enough.
Right, exactly. Could you tell us a little bit more about that story, though? Because it's been a while since you've been here, and we've acquired a different group of listeners, about how you went from being homeless to where you are now.
Well, yeah. So the homeless moment, like going from 20 million to negative 5 million in 2008, it was a reckoning. And it, to me, looking back, it was a big opportunity. It was a gift. It was a moment where I got to realize, wow, okay, maybe I'm on the wrong track. Because I think we get these lessons from the universe, and either there's flow or there's a smack in the face. And sometimes you get run over by a truck if you don't really pay attention. And so after that moment where I lost that money and was homeless for a brief period of time, I started asking different questions. I started asking, like, you know, what's it all about? Why am I here? And what's my purpose? Is it just to go make more money? Cause you can learn from your mistakes and then go make more money leveraging those mistakes. But the question I had was, is the focus supposed to be on going and making money, or is money the side effect? And ultimately I realized that there was an opportunity to take all of these lessons and the excitement about serving people and building something that was more of a teaching and empowering model. And that was the big shift. And I think we have to have a bit of a train wreck to get to the place where we can let go of just the money being the focus and really start figuring out how to serve. And that's where everything has been. It's been all based on that philosophy the last decade. And before that, it was really all about the money. So it was success, and then more, it's now significance and impact. And I think that is the winning playbook for happiness. Everything else is really fleeting. And anymore, Adam, there's never enough. We see more shiny objects and more people
doing
things and we chase it. And I think we have to get away from that.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'm with you on that. So basically, that is a great story. And I do remember that from last time. So thanks for sharing it again. Give me a little bit of refresher. So let me just start at the top, and then we'll just break it down into component pieces. There's money I didn't know I had. Where is it?
Well, I think a lot of the money that we don't know we have is lost and stuck in retirement accounts. We have this happen. It's crazy. We have people show up every day that have tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars that's floating around in the system, and they didn't even realize they, one, had it, and two, that they actually have the ability to tap into it. And that's not just for retirement purposes, but people are oftentimes trying to figure out how they start a business or how they do something, and they don't realize they have capital they can tap into that's just sitting there. That's this dormant asset. And a lot of times it's because it was from 5 or 10 years ago, and they just had something they kind of mindlessly put into a 401k, and they never really thought about it, and it's sitting there. I mean, there's literally trillions of dollars that are orphaned accounts, and people don't even realize that they're out there. So that's a big chunk of money that for most people, most people have that sitting around, and they just don't even realize it or think about it.
Right. Because I certainly don't know anything about that. And I think most people don't.
No, and one of the things that it happens for most people, when you start a job, you have this opportunity to throw money in and have an employer match it. We often do that because we're signing a bunch of documents, and then it happens, and we don't really think about it because it's like fake money. It's like this thing, and it's not money; it's in our checking account, and so we just don't think about it. And for most people, it's a really good idea for them to do that, to get these employer matches and to really start thinking more: what could I do with that? Because most people aren't going to be in the same job. Eventually, you're going to have a different job, or you're going to start your own business. You're going to do something, and then there's this pile. So it's something to be mindful of. I think for most people, it's an afterthought; they just don't really give it a lot of consciousness. And then ultimately it ends up being something that's sitting there that they never thought about. It's lost, forgotten money.
Right. Precisely. So, So expand more on that and give us, I guess, sort of a framework for where we can begin to consider this path of, you know, what do you want to call it, finding this money or developing these sources of revenue. And because again, you know, I think a lot of people are finding challenges with their percentage of revolving credit utilization, which is cutting things off. I'm hearing that story more and more. I think that there are, you know, and as far as, you know, traditional lending, if you're an entrepreneur, you can pretty much forget that at this point, at least my personal opinion. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think that's, I think ever anymore, it's getting harder and harder with regulations and just our whole system to tap into to traditional sources. So, you know, not only can you tap into your own retirement accounts, but one of the cool things when you're thinking about this like found money, most people that are around you, your neighbors, your friends, your family, your coworkers, most people also have these piles of money that are sitting there. And what I think is interesting is that we've had a lot of stories where people are like, oh, you know, I found out that these retirement accounts could be used for stuff other than just going to Wall Street. So then they start talking to their friends, and ultimately their friends have retirement accounts that they can then invest with the person and in their venture. And so what happens is we start having Main Street investing with Main Street. It starts to be this, that they're serving each other versus just going and begging the bank for some money for an idea or for a loan, for maybe an investment, for starting a business. That kind of stuff. I mean, there's something like $30 trillion sitting in these retirement accounts. And that's all the fuel in the world. What's really frustrating, and you alluded to it, it's very hard to get things done in a traditional environment where you go to a bank and you basically beg them and they say no because you don't have something that's foolproof. You have an idea. Your neighbors, your friends, they're more likely to say, yeah, I want to be a part of this with you because it's human. Whereas banks, they think about the money. They're not thinking about anything else. If they think about the community, it's because they're forced to by federal regulators. But their problem, and I think that it's our opportunity, is that they're narrowly focused on only things that are already proven. And so when we're forced to switch and go outside of that, and we start having to connect with real people, we can start tapping into all these resources that are sitting there dormant, and then we can start building things again. And I think that's where there's this huge opportunity, and people don't even realize it's an option.
Right. Yeah. So what do you think is, going on as far as, because you mentioned in your bio that you have a mission to free a million everyday investors from the broken traditional retirement system. And I can tell you that just between everything that's happened economically in the past couple of years or whatever, I'll just come out and say it. I don't have a lot left there anyway. So I've been thinking about what I'm going to do with the money that's left. And could I just yank that out, knowing that I'd have to pay a bit of a penalty on it, I get that, and start doing something else with it.
And I think for a lot of people, that's actually a really good plan to say, okay, I'm just going to exit the system and I'm going to put this totally in my hands. I think a lot of times people, they don't think about it. So there isn't a lot of opportunities inside of retirement accounts where you can grow things. You can do it tax efficiently or even tax free. I also think that there's sometimes it makes sense to say, I'm going to be out of the system because I don't want anybody telling me what I can't do or can do. And so sometimes people let the tax dog or the tax tail wag the dog, and they say, well, I just don't want to pay taxes, so I'll keep myself trapped. And like what you just said, hey, if you're willing to take a little bit of pain, which might be some taxes, maybe a penalty, you do have the ability to be more free. So that could be part of the formula. When we think about freeing a million people from financial bondage, it's figuring out ways with them, really intimately, like one-on-one, what's the thing, how are we going to create freedom for you? Sometimes it's taking yourself out of the system. Sometimes it's taking yourself and putting yourself deeper into the system. It's ultimately putting people in control. And that's the shift. It's about putting you in control of your outcome, your destiny. Okay, because I don't know if you've heard this from people, but it makes me crazy when I hear somebody say, well, I guess I'll just wait and see what happens. And I'm like, that's your life plan, to wait and see what happens, wait and see what happens with an election, wait and see what happens with the economy. The difference with between that and people that are going to be free, or the people that are going to be free, are the ones that are saying, I'm going to go out there and make it happen. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that. But it's more about the philosophy than it is even the mechanics. It's about that there's an author named Larry Winget, who I really like.
Yeah, I know Larry.
Yeah, he's great. He's one of these bald guys. Like, you know, I like his style. And he said, look, one of his books is called Your Life Is Your Own Damn Fault. And
I have that book.
Yeah, and everybody should get that book. It's his philosophy, and another one of them is, shut up, stop whining, and get a life. I think people are so sensitive and so much victims that they don't realize the power in saying, all right, if it's going to be, it's up to me. And that's the big secret. It's like, all right, I'm going to own it. It's going to be my responsibility. And then you know what? You're going to go do the work. And that's the thing that I think people are missing anymore. It's the victim, and they don't want to do the work. And that's where all the opportunity is.
I get it. So I guess, let's say somebody is just starting out with investment. And I know in today's world, especially with how challenging it can be to even get a career going or get a business going, some folks that are younger don't even have the opportunity to get started yet because they don't, I mean, they're essentially 135% of their income is going to their student loan.
I think,
I know that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I think for some people, it's really not.
it's a sad reality. I think about when I went to college 20 years ago and I took a little student loan out and I ended up paying it back. I think about the debt burden that people that a lot of these kids have, and I get why they're all upset, but I also think that they've allowed themselves to get conned into a system where it's about consuming and there's a complete disregard. And granted, when you're 18, you don't know anything, hardly, but there's a disregard around reality and the reality of economics, and that consuming, you have to produce something to consume. They're just doing it in the reverse order. But to somebody that says, well, I can't afford it. I see this on TikTok and Facebook. I see these people crying about how they can't even afford to go and do anything. They can never afford to buy a home. And I look at them and I go, I guarantee you, if we took 168 hours of your week, you've got time that you're putting on something else and you're not doing a side hustle. You're not doing something where you're building something. You're not going out and learning a new skill. I guarantee you that you've got time that you are putting into something that is not making you better or stronger or more money. You're squandering it. So I don't have a lot of sympathy after having spent 25 years of grinding and pushing it for somebody that says, look, I'm in a bunch of debt. Look, I get it.
I'm in a bunch of debts.
Right. It's look, the debt can be taken. I don't care how much debt you're in, there is a plan that you can take yourself out of the debt. And it's not fun, but the reality is I think it makes people stronger when they go through it, when they don't say, oh, please, Joe Biden, cancel my debt. I mean, if that happens, what are you actually going to learn? You're going to be basically beholden to whoever's going to save you the next time, instead of saying, all right, I've got debt. I got myself in that debt. I'm going to fix it. That there's an incredible power there and a freedom knowing that you're capable and you trust yourself to go solve the problem. That's what's missing for most people.
Because the government's not coming to save you. Anybody that thinks that. And as far as the let me tell you my thoughts about the whole student debt cancellation thing. Between the amount I borrowed for undergrad and the amount I borrowed for my MBA, the initial like once I put those two together, the initial print principal was something like $54,000. When it all got consolidated in 2003 and I started paying them both off. So that was 21 years ago. I have current as of a month ago, I have paid something like $78,000 back and still owe 14,000 more. So first of all, you're already seeing my problem. So with that in mind, I feel like they've already bent me over and ripped me pretty good. So you damn right. I looked into student loan forgiveness, but then what I found out is that I don't fit in any of their categories. And to me, this is just a personal opinion. I'm not looking, and this isn't a political show, nor do I want to take it there. But I'm just going to tell you my impression is that it's based on who their donors are, basically the classes of people. Because I notice it's basically people who are classified as working in certain industries that have a lot of union involvement is what I noticed. Those
Yeah,
are the
you can
ones we
prove it.
seem that those are the ones they seem to have the incentives for student loan forgiveness. Me, I don't get any. But the way I looked at it is I took out $53,000. I've already paid back $78,000. They've gotten 50% ROI on me. That's good enough. If I can get a break, I'll take it. If everybody else is. And now let me develop that one step further is I can also look at that logically and say, well, wait a minute, but if everybody thought that way, yeah, you're absolutely right. If everybody thinks that way, people are going to start acting that way. So that's not the healthiest thing for a society. But people will come to a point like I did where I say, you know what, to hell with it. If everybody else is doing it, I'm doing it. But that's not a way to build wealth. All that would do is loosen a bit of my cash flow every month.
Well, and I just think people are, there's a disconnect between what's reality and what is real with debt and with money. People just don't really, they don't understand it, and it takes time and energy. Our system is set up to have the system win and for us to basically be fuel. It's like the Matrix. And I saw an example online recently. There was a couple that was really excited. They were standing, they looked excited. They were posting a picture of their new truck that they just bought. And it was a $3,000 a month payment for 96 months, almost $300,000 in payments over 8 years for a $100,000 truck.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at that, and how in the world does that make sense? It made sense because they probably made 100 grand together, and a financing company said, yeah, they can afford a third of their income to this vehicle, and we will extract it out of them. And they're not thinking about the kind of bondage that they're putting themselves into. The problem is people want everything now. They don't want to wait.
Yeah.
And they don't understand that the consequences of doing it, because all they see is $3,000 a month, and they see a shiny new truck that they think the truck somehow is $3,000. They don't realize it's $300,000.
That's the thing. And in marketing, we know this. You put something on a payment plan, and they see the payment plan number. They don't see the next two payments. For example, let's say I'm selling a webinar with a six week coaching program for $19.97. Mm-hmm. Now, Damon, I tell you $19.97, you're going to say, well, let me think about that. Not that your stuff isn't good, but let me think about that, because that's a lot of money to be out right now, even though my money's good. On the other hand, if I say, tell you the exact same thing, and I say it's six payments of $387, which I don't have the math in front of me, but that's actually going to make it something like $2,200 or $2,300, give or take. So you're going to pay a lot more money than the $19.97. All you're going to see is $387, and you're going to very quickly do a pass in your mind that says, yeah, I'll have that every month, mm-hmm. and you'll sign up. Never mind, I just got $300 or $400 out of you for the exact same thing. But I got you to see a smaller number, so that the $2,300 or whatever, you didn't see that number at all. All you saw was $19.97, which would be a hit, versus $387, which you felt a sense of relief from, that became real and tangible and doable for you.
That's the fallacy, the small number fallacy, and you're exactly right. Marketing mm-hmm. is, and marketing is done by marketers. It's done by banks. Banks are full of marketers and sociologists and psychologists, and this it comes down to us seeing this thing that feels good right now, and we don't go deeper than the surface level. And that, I think that's where most people are in life. They don't go deeper. And because thinking is, I mean, there's a lot of energy required with thinking through things, but people wonder why they have the problems in their life. It's because they haven't thought through things, and that takes energy and it's hard, but that's where freedom is. It's digging right. deeper than just the feeling in the moment.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, here's another thing I saw, because I've looked in the, you know, taught myself a lot of things, particularly how consumers can find themselves being in some ways taken advantage of. There are, if you go to certain, you know, if you follow some of those articles that say, here are 10 ways to make $1,000 in 24 hours. If you look at some of those articles, you may find a link to something where it allows you to buy groceries or things in a grocery store, things in a department store, and spend and stretch your payments over 12 months. And this is positioned as you're paying off another credit card, which means you're going to build your credit score. Now, that may be the case. It may help your credit. I don't know. But what I do know is that I did the calculations, and I saw that they were selling a particular bottle of cologne. And they said, if you buy through our program, you put it on the 12-month payment plan, you'll pay this tiny little amount per month, and then you'll own it. Okay, first of all, that bottle of cologne is not going to last a year. You're going to be paying for it after it's over. Trust me, I wear cologne. I've never gotten a year out of a bottle. That's number one. Number two, that same bottle that through their little program you would have paid $150 for, I can get that for $60 at the mall. Same
That's yeah.
fragrance, same size bottle. But see what they but what they do is they say, imagine having this high-end cologne for $3 a day or $5 a week. And they get you to stop thinking about the fact that they're basically going to charge you triple.
Yeah, because they're selling the feeling. They're not selling anything beyond the feeling, and we're basically emotional feeling beings, and we react with our feelings. We tend to not make decisions based on logic. We do what's going to feel good. It's why people go out and buy rims on their cars, and they do a 48-month payment plan because they feel like, hey, look, people are going to look at my shiny spinning rims. They were $4,000, and granted, I'm working at Chick-fil-A and making $12 an hour. But somehow it makes sense for me to have these rims. But hey, they're only $150 a month. I can afford that flipping chicken sandwiches.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and that's what you see. I put a system in my Camaro in the 1990s while working in fast food, and I paid for that whole thing in cash. So, but it was actually kind of the same thing as I recognized that I figured I estimate how much it was going to be for all the equipment and all the ancillaries and everything, approximately how many months I'd need to do it, how much work I need to do to get there. You can go down the line or what have you. And I viewed it as every month I was putting so much away for it. And once I had a certain amount of money to buy the next component, I would. Or if I got a really good deal on a component I could that was on a list, I would have the money there. I could just go pick it up. But see, that right there is a little bit, at least a little bit smarter because I had a goal of something specifically I wanted to attain. And when people used to ask me, why do you need a system in your Camaro? It's like, you know what the answer was, Damien? I'm going to give you a chance to tell me what the answer is to why I had to have a competition level auto sound system in my 1988 Camaro.
I mean, either you're trying to prove something to your buddies, or you're trying to get a date. Something's happening.
Because I fucking wanted to.
Oh, there's that
The
too.
fact the fact the fact that my buddies liked all of a sudden wanted me to drive whenever we went places, and the fact that the women did come running, those are ancillaries. I like the idea of having some boom boom in my ride, so I did it.
We, you know,
So
there's something you're.
what I picked up there is your responses to my question when I left it open to you is that it's based on at least what I picked up from, and you may have had a different intention or no intention at all. It's based on how other people perceive the value. So, okay, so your buddies think you're cool. So the chicks think you're hot. And so it's an idea of using it as a status symbol for other people. And the way I looked at it is, I just want it. And we're allowed to have things in life. And if we're willing to work for them, we deserve them, period.
I think people that they think they deserve things, but they haven't actually earned them yet. And I think that that's the thing that gets people tripped up.
Oh,
I love,
unpack this one for me. This is interesting.
yeah, you're when you said you went out and you paid for it. I think that that's the missing element. I think that it's really interesting when we go and we say, okay, I want that thing, and you're forced to throw down some Benjamins, or you have to actually pay for it out of your checking account versus credit card. We tend to slow down, and the reality is we don't really want as many things as we thought. But when we don't have to have a reality check, when we can just pay for it with this fictitious future money, we're more inclined to buy every shiny thing that makes us feel good. So there is power in what you did, and it's smart, and it keeps us sane. The other stuff, all this credit and finance, is literally being used against us because it's not real. It just allows us to live a life that we haven't yet earned. And I think that that's what's killing people.
Well, it's killing me and almost everybody I know, candidly. Because first you get in a hole because you have to, then because you want to, then because you really have to, et cetera, ad infinitum. And it's challenging to get out of that loop sometimes. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to speak with you. And part of the conversation we're having here is actually a mindset conversation rather than some specifics that you can share. Let me just ask you, just out of candor, I believe you're a licensed financial advisor of some point of some type.
So I've got the designation that I've got. It's called a CCIM. It's a commercial certified investment manager. So it's really a designation for training. It's not a licensing thing. And the difference is I can say whatever I want. I don't have anybody telling me that you can't say something. You can't say this or that, which is it's pretty damn empowering.
Oh yeah, I've worked with financial advisors before, and the challenge is just watching their compliance departments, who don't have a clue to begin with in most cases, just dismantle everything they try and do as far as marketing. I remember I was working with one financial advisor, and he was one of the top in his country, in his company, actually. I'm not going to say his name, because I'm not going to get him in trouble. And it's like every time he wanted to write a blog post, every time he wanted to send an email, every time he wanted to do, go on social media, he had to deal with his compliance department. It had some 22-year-old kid who read a manual yesterday saying, I don't like that. And so what my client did is he knew how to push back and say, all right, but am I allowed to say it? And it's like, I don't care what you like. Am I allowed to say it? And see, he was one of the relative few that would push back like that. And now I know that, myself, I kind of lost interest in that when I wrote some emails that client was going to send. And then I got a lecture from their compliance department about the subject lines and how they weren't direct and specific enough. And they suggested that I study things like can spam. It's like, honey, I know can spam, castle, GDPR. I know 1,000 times more about this than you. So, and following what my client would say, I say, is this really a problem or do you just not like it? Because I'm not interested in what you like. I'm interested in what we're being allowed to say. So believe it or not, they saw it my way and let me have my client send the email out the way they wanted it. But then my client said to me, I just want you to be aware that compliance monitors my emails. And I said, I don't care. I'll say what I want. Because apparently I sent a private note to him in which I called that compliance person a bonehead or something like that. And I guess she saw it and pointed out to him. I said, I'll say whatever I want. I have freedom of speech. If she doesn't want to be called a bonehead by me, maybe she shouldn't act like one.
I think that's candid conversation and opinions are, I think they're incredibly important. And it's one of the unfortunate things with things that get more and more regulated and you have all this oversight. Everybody's playing safe. And can you imagine if Elon Musk had played it safe? Like just like you think about the people that are big, that are great innovators and do things. And we would be nowhere. We'd be run by a bunch of Washington, D.C. bureaucrats and nothing would be done. It'd be like the unionization of America would be a complete disaster. But that's the difference in saying what needs to be said, being direct and cowering down and saying, okay, what am I allowed to say? You know, getting permission from mommy and daddy, I think is nonsense. Just being honest and candid. That's what we need. Jack Welch said that. He said that the missing thing in business is candor. When I saw him 15 years ago, he made that comment and it's never been truer. Now it's like you say something, you get canceled, you get slapped, everybody's offended. People are saying, oh my gosh, my feeling got hurt. It's like, give me a break, get over it. If you can't handle it, you need to grow a pair. Like, I mean, it's getting to the point where it's so obnoxious that everybody's cowering around wondering if they're allowed to even breathe. And I'm pretty sick of it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. And the reason I bring this up is because I think people are afraid of, or can they even trust the information because it's been so regulated and so standardized and so synonymized that they can go to one of 12 financial advisors, so to speak. And I know that you're not that type of financial advisor per se. And they'll actually get told the same thing by 12 different people because those 12 different people have 10 other people watching over their shoulder. Like I knew somebody from the cigar shop who used to live in Vegas. He's moved since, but he was a financial advisor. And he used to tell me that if he wanted to send any email to any client of his, he had to draft it and put it in a queue and have compliance review it first. And he found out that meant every single time because he hadn't had an email exchange with one of his clients. And at the end of the exchange, he replied to say, thanks. That was the whole message. Thanks. And he apparently got penalized for it because thanking your client for information you asked for requires review. And see what I mean?
That's the nature of our systems. It's all about permission. It's crazy. Being creative, wanting to communicate. Apparently now it's got to go through a sift and a filter, and it has to be perfectly pasteurized and sanitized. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. I think that one of the things I was told years ago by Dan Sullivan, with Strategic Coach, he said, look, if I'm going to look at a business, I'm looking at businesses that are not regulated, that are open for business. And the more and more things get regulated, the less, and you know, you think about that with oversight and people that monitor your emails, and you can't say most things, like, they're just not any fun. So what the hell is the point in being involved in them? I personally have no interest in doing things where I have some government bureaucrat or some woke middle manager saying, this is what you can and can't do because of our policies and procedures. Like, right. Give me a break. Let's be real here.
Uh-huh. Seriously. And I'm not going to get into that discussion about social issues and virtual signaling, anything like that. I let people make those decisions for themselves. But yeah, I've had people come to me whenever there's some hot, you know, social outrage or something, and demand that I take a stand or my business issue some statement. And I say, no, unless you're paying me, I don't have to do anything for you. So you paying me? No, they just wanted to get me to join some virtue signal bandwagon.
I'm 100% with you. Could not agree more.
Uh-huh. We had an interesting episode on this. We had Vito Glazers is his name. We did an episode on the Business Creators Radio Show, moving from cancel culture to conversation culture. And the idea behind it is, rather than ostracize people and demand that they conform to certain ideological messages, that we create an environment where we can openly discuss things without having to make sure that they're languaged exactly properly. I saw this thing the other day, and I think it was from one of the major universities, in light of the recent shootings that they had at the parade for the Chiefs. They were speaking about ways to deal with student trauma at this university, and somewhere in one of the bullet points, it said something like, it said, professors should consider that it may be necessary to adjust camera requirements for Zoom calls. I read that, like, what? It's like, unless I'm being interviewed for a video podcast, I don't turn my camera on. I don't care. And do you have people that actually will turn look at whether somebody's webcam is turned on during a Zoom call as either a statement of their beliefs or something you need to be sensitive to in order to not encroach upon their feelings?
You know, honestly, that makes me want to vomit a little bit in my mouth. Yeah,
so can we just talk about making some money?
It's kind of embarrassing to thinking about how everybody is so overly sensitive about everything, and there's so much judgment. I just want to tell people, hey, you know what? Get over it. Get back to work. Like, this right. is – they're spending so much time thinking about the wrong things. We wonder why there's troubles and there's problems in America or in society. And I think a lot of it has to do with all of this wasted energy and the misdirection of where our efforts and focus should be.
Why do you think they're doing that? And I think this is pertinent to our discussion because it does tie into what people do with their, you know, what people do with their money.
I think it's a way to keep people distracted and dumb and numb. And if people are not empowered, if they're not focused, then they're going to be more likely to say, all right, I have a problem. Please save me. Please solve this. And it keeps people trapped. And if people are trapped, then the people that have resources or control, whether it's governments or institutions, financial institutions, they have the ability to manipulate and use people as feed and fodder. I mean, we're talking about the Matrix. So the more people that are bitching about whatever the current woke thing is, or how life is hard and they're not focused on actually creating a solution, the more you're going to have people that are going to support whatever agenda you're going to have in your power position. I mean, that's what we're seeing more and more over and over again, both nationally, and we're seeing it globally. People are saying, come save me. And that is the absolute wrong thing, but it makes sense for sociopathic power mongers. That's what they want. They want people to be weak, lost, confused, dazed, and asking for help. And that's what we've got.
Yeah, Damon, you and I have known each other for a couple years, mostly in terms of being on each other's podcasts and such. So you're probably at least familiar enough with me to know that I have a business that is based on a laptop that I carry around with me and take it to different places throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
So can you imagine my reaction when somebody thought they were going to lecture me because my company had not issued a statement of our recognition of the severity of COVID-19 and urging people to wear masks and get vaccinated?
Here's a rabbit hole.
Yeah. So we took about a 10-minute tangent here, and I did this actually for a reason. Everything, it's all for a reason. That being that I wanted folks to understand some of the pressures that exist even in the world of business and some of these influences that dictate the availability of money. I mean, you want to talk about ESG scores. That's another example. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have your credit rating impacted by whether or not you say woke stuff on social media. Are you freaking kidding me?
Yeah, and I mean, I had experiences about that, you know, this week, where watching people and feeling the wrath of people with their super sensitive little feelings, wanting to say that, gosh, they don't want to hear certain things, and it's, I think people, quite frankly, have just become very, very weak, and they don't have the ability to. I mean, that's just where we're at.
They don't want to hear things, so nobody else can say them. Here's the way I look at it: freedom of speech. You can say whatever you want, right? Now, if I don't like your speech, I can ask you to not share that speech in my presence. I can ask you to do that. And if you respect me, you will do that. If you respect me, but at the same time feel that I should respect you, then you could also say, well, you have as much right to say anything as I do, so I'm going to say it. You can call me names if you want to because I said it, but whatever, and we can just agree to disagree. That's also an appropriate approach. But for somebody to approach me and say, you can't say that in my presence, no, it doesn't work that way. If there does have to come a point where if you're in an environment where things are being said or things are happening that you just personally don't like, you got to just pick up and leave, man.
That's the difference between your philosophy and I think what's out there. People think that they're entitled to have everybody change their behaviors so that they feel a certain way instead of saying, look, I can move out of this environment. Or, you know, like when people go, oh, this video offends me. Like you literally chose to go watch the video. You're doing this thing. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that makes me bananas, where people are there. It's all about their feelings and they don't think about anybody else's rights or feelings. It's just about them. It's very, very self-centered. And I don't have a lot of tolerance for that. You should be able to do what you want and think what you want, say what you want. And so should I. I'm not going to inflict my will on you. And you don't have any, there's no requirement that you listen to me or be around me. Like if you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. Like, but just because you have a different opinion or you don't like hearing certain things, if I'm going to swear and you don't like swearing, then you know what? Don't be around me. Don't listen to me. But that doesn't mean that I have to change my behaviors. And then I have to just try to figure out, for me, the whole pronoun thing, I need to be called a dog or I need to be called a whatever.
Yeah.
Because I identify that way. I mean, give me an effing break. Like, really?
Yeah. We covered that on that episode with Vito Glazers. I mean, to me, my exposure to the pronoun thing began in the 1980s in Catholic school. And this is when we had a large influx of Asians migrating into the United States. And the issue was people with names like Lee and Kim, which, if you're a native United States English speaker, have heard, you generally think of as being a male or female name. Like Lee, you, at least that point in the 80s, you usually thought L-E-E, a man's name. L-E-I-G-H is a female name, for example, was just coming into its own. As far as Kim, you almost universally thought of Kimberly, which, although it technically is actually a boy's name, has become in practice a girl's name.
Right.
So you're seeing these, and I'm just saying it was presented to us because of, and he said the stated reason we're speaking with you about this is because we have so many more Asian people joining our community, and we want to make sure that we don't make assumptions about their gender, which is fair. And we were taught at the time, unless you know for sure, just use they, them. Which to me is reasonable. Like, if, I mean, like Damian Lupo. I mean, I've seen your videos. I know you're a man, right? So mm-hmm. I'm gonna refer to you as a guy. But if I saw Damian Lupo and I wasn't sure who or what that was, I might say in an internal conversation with my producer, for example, I might say, oh, it's Damian Lupo, wants to be on the Business Creators Radio Show. Interesting. Tell them that I'm happy to speak with them, and if you could please work with it so they and you can schedule the interview. That's reasonable. But for you to come to me and demand that I somehow should have known your chosen pronouns before we even begin, and then say it's somehow my fault if I didn't know, because here's how I look at it. If you came to me and said you wanted to use pronouns that indicated you're a bug, I would respect that because you can do whatever you want with your name. I'd use your bug pronouns. I don't care. Just tell me what you want. But at the same time, because I don't want to play this pronoun game at all, don't expect me to play the game. And if you really want to push me on it, I'll say this. If you can't figure me out without me declaring some pronoun to you, then you're probably not close enough to me where it's really any of your business, is it?
There you go. I'm amazed that people spend so much time fighting this space. You know, they want to fight over being like the things that are important to people. That's one of the nice things about America. We can say this matters to me, but I also have the right to say this is the dumbest thing ever, and I don't really care. And I certainly, like Jordan Peterson talks about this a lot, that it's just, and so does, you know, guys like Ben Shapiro. It makes no rational sense, but that's the key here. This is not rational. It's very emotional, and it's about identity politics, and it's about things that we're really not talking about. We're just talking about how you should respect me because I have this thing that I want to enforce my will on you. And to me, that's not freedom. That's tyranny. That's tyranny by the minority. And I'm not interested in supporting that. I'm going to push back on that if I ever get pushed on it.
Do you see a lot of that in the financial world in terms of what you're expected to encourage? I mean, not that you would necessarily follow this, but maybe peer pressure that you may see in the industry that you may yourself be immune to in terms of how you're supposed to encourage your clients to invest, what types of companies to look for, what types of funds or plans or something like that.
The way that we really have built things out in the organization is we've given people the power to do whatever they want, and that's the nature of it. And then the actual investments, the projects like FrameTech that we were building, we're creating something that is such a universal win that everybody gets excited about it. There's nobody that says, well, this is bad, because it's good for the environment, it's good for the people. People love being there because we treat them like family. The investors do really well. So when you have things like ESG, you've got this very twisted approach, and it's not that the environment is bad. It's not that being socially thoughtful is bad. It's that when you're imposing a will and saying this is how it's going to be, and we're going to take away from you, we're going to steal from you because we have a philosophy that, quite frankly, isn't based on truth. It's based on your religion, if you will. Like some of these things, I think that there's a difference between doing the right thing and making all the stakeholders win, and saying it's going to be ESG, and we're going to let this government bureaucrat decide what that means, which feeds into things like Wall Street when they're saying, okay, we're only going to have these certain types of investments that are going to work for these pension funds. They're imposing a will that's not really rational. It's about somebody's agenda. It's about who's going to control other people. And that's what I see happening with these like top-down centralized control methods versus people making a decision. Hey, I want to invest in a thing. I want to be a part of a thing because it's very thoughtful about all the parties. They're all winners versus no, we can only do this thing because it's ESG certified. Like, you know, that kind of stuff is, I think that's the doom. And that's the part of when you centralize more and more power into these structures, whether it's the US government or it's BlackRock or or Chase Bank or whatever, then you see more of this manipulation. It's not based on truth or reality. It's based on these very vocal minority interests, and the rest of the people are like, this doesn't even make any sense. But they're too busy either working or just don't want to be in the fight. And you get crazies on the edge that are the ones that are driving the narrative. That's the problem.
Right, right, right. Okay, so let's wrap this up with something that our listeners can view as actionable and usable. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is ask you about a quick case study. And then I want to ask you for just a couple techniques. So do you have any like particular investment stories from your own portfolio that can highlight your approach and insight so that people can begin to understand how it is to work with you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the current stuff I'm doing, I think, is the most relevant just because it takes everything and aggregates it. And when it's kind of like math, like you don't go to calculus before you do trigonometry and geometry, like there's a stepping stone. And so the project I'm working with FrameTech now is, I think it's a great way to look at things. From my perspective, it took 46 years to get here. And the way I look at that with investing, I mean, I'm looking at the people. And I think that is one of the biggest misses that people make. You got to start with the people that are driving whatever it is that is being built, that you're investing in, that you're a part of. And the people are the ones that are going to do it. They're going to solve the problems. If you've got a great idea and you have the wrong people, it's dead. Doesn't matter. You could have great people and a lukewarm thing, and you're going to have a very high likelihood of a success because they can pivot and they can think. So, you know, in terms of a case study, I came into this world 2 years ago with a napkin. Some people came to me and they said, we have this idea. We want to build this manufacturing plant that is going to be the most advanced automated framing manufacturing system in the country. And we have this idea. And I said, all right, tell me about you guys. And they talked about their background being in this world for 50 years. I knew some of them the last 25. And when I really understood and trusted who they were and their drive and their experience, then I said, all right, I don't really understand the manufacturing piece, but I understand you and I trust you. And so I said, yeah, you've got your $40 million. And it was over at lunch. And that's how I lead my decisions. It's, do I trust the people to execute? And if I trust that, I think a lot of people look at the numbers and they say, oh, this is great. I'm going to make 17% or 12%, or the past average historical number is this. And they're not really thinking about the people that are driving the actual outcome. It has everything to do with the people. And if you have the right people, I've had the wrong people, and I'm paying a price for having some of the wrong people in previous things. I have bad people, bad actors, and it doesn't matter how good the deal is. They're going to figure out how to lose the money. They're going to figure out how to steal the money. So I think that's the key thing. Who are you dealing with? And if you don't know who you're dealing with, do not do anything. You got to go deep into the who first, and then the how plays out if you have the right who. That's what I've learned in 46 years. That is the most important thing. It's the who.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. And then as a final question here, just before I share the invitation that you have for our audience, is just, you know, finally, let's say somebody was looking at this right now and they want to just do something today. They want to take a step forward. How do you, you know, what is the first piece of advice you would suggest they do?
I think the first piece of advice is to find something outside of your normal environment that is part of what you want in your life. It's part of the vision outside. It could be as simple as saying, okay, I'm going to go spend some time in a more wealthy place, or I'm going to spend time at a conference with people that are more successful. It could be anything. Yeah. The thing that gets people stuck is they stay in these legacy environments with the legacy people, and they go, well, I love my family. And I'm like, I'm not saying you should fire your family. Maybe you should. But what I'm saying is that if you put yourself in an environment that's more like your vision of your life, you're more likely to naturally do it. If you don't change anything, you are going to have the same life you have now in 10 years. That is just how it is. It's called entrenched reality. You're not going to make a change. Shifting your environment is an unbelievable hack. And I mean, that's when I move, I ask myself, what environment is going to support me? What people in my life are going to support my vision for what I want to do in terms of generosity and making an impact on the world? I don't go back to the people I went to high school with. Most of those people are deadbeats. They don't do anything other than do what they did last year. So shifting the environment in one way, in one little thing, it's sort of weirdly addictive. You'll want to do it. And that your environment could be your physical environment. It could be where you go and invest. You could say, well, I want to do something where I want to start investing in Bitcoin. I want to throw $10 at it. That's a different environment. You're in a different world. It doesn't take a lot, but it takes something, some step that's physically noticeable, and you start to shift your ability to be comfortable in something new.
A friend of mine who does his own investing independently, what he does is he'll do something like he'll throw $10 at a Bitcoin, or if he sees a stock that looks interesting, he'll buy sometimes as low as one share using one of those apps where you can do individual share purchasing without a middle person. And just the idea of keeping his mind in it, seeing what he can do with his money. And the way he does it, explained to me analogically, is it's like in baseball, you're hitting singles. You're not everything has to be a home run. You keep hitting a lot of singles.
That's it. It's the singles. Everybody tries to get a home run, and the reality is the people in their Hall of Fame, most of those people hit a lot of singles, and then they struck out even more. And if you're so concerned that you need to hit a home run, otherwise you're not even going to swing, you're basically, again, you're going to stay in the same environment, and your life
You've
20 years,
surrendered. Yeah, you
it's the same
surrendered a
game.
game before you played. You surrendered before you played.
That's
Yep.
right.
All right. So what I invite our listeners to do, we've had a very wide-ranging conversation and went way beyond the original intention. But as far as how to be financially free and find the money you don't have, we did cover that at the beginning. And the reason that I made room for some other topics that are on the periphery of the financial world is so that we can see some of the influences and pressures that may be brought upon you as you try to make the best decision. But the bottom line here is you want to find money you didn't know you have. So go to www. Let me pull it up here right now. www.vitruvianventures. VitruvianVenturesCom. And when you get there, you're going to see Damien's website. So this is where you can be financially free, and he will show you how. So with that, Damian Lupo, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an honor and, believe me, an education.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.